Hello and welcome to The Priest and the Prof. I am your host, the Reverend Deborah Duguid-May.
And I'm Dr. M. Elizabeth Thorpe.
This podcast is a product of Trinity Episcopal Church in Greece, New York. I'm an Episcopal priest of 26 years, and Elizabeth has been a rhetoric professor since 2010. And so join us as we explore the intersections of faith, community, politics, philosophy, and action. Welcome. So in our episode today, Elizabeth and I are going to continue this Christmas series looking at how Luke and Matthew deal in the birth narratives with the issue of gender. And I don't know about you, Elizabeth, but I'm excited for this podcast. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's important for us to just, in the very beginning, remember that gender is about how we socially and culturally construct these ideas of what role a person is suited to based on their biological sex. So it's these social and cultural constructed ideas of what behavior is appropriate and how biological sex should or shouldn't be expressed outwardly. Now, because gender is so shaped by our society and culture, we have to remember that, of course, in the biblical narratives, we're dealing with a specific culture and time period very different from our own. Just as we today are having to navigate gender in our own cultures and generation. Elizabeth, would you say that's a fair summary so we understand what we mean when we're talking about gender?
Yeah, I want to be very clear and just because this is something I'm particularly interested in.
Right.
When we talk about gender and sex, we're talking about two different things.
Yeah, right? Biological sex.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah,
that's very important for people to understand.
Right.
Gender is your outward expression of who you are and how you see yourself fitting into society and the role you want to take, whereas sex is
Biologically, physically, how you were born, male, female,
and I'll talk about this in just a few minutes,
okay,
but
good.
That's something we need to start with very clearly.
Right, because I wanted to be clear when we're speaking about these Christmas narratives and gender, what we mean by that.
Yeah.
Yes, that's
exactly where you need to start.
Okay, beautiful. Exactly. So Luke's gospel does something very interesting with gender, because although we find some traditional gender roles and behavior in Luke's gospel, like a woman giving birth, there are many other ways in which we see Luke presenting some pretty radical concepts that would have really challenged the gender norms of the time. Now, in Luke's gospel, women are really at the center. Unlike most patriarchal texts, which the Bible, of course, is, where we have the stories of men, the telling of what they have said and done and how it shaped society and history, in Luke, we have the woman and what they are saying and doing and how that is shaping history and their culture being right at the heart of the gospel. And so women's lives that were traditionally lived in the private spaces of the home and their conversations and relationships that were kept generally between women privately are now central and placed centrally in this public story. And I think that in itself is very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
This shifting of women's lives from the private to the public as central characters really is not normative in patriarchal cultures or storytelling. And then we have Mary, as we looked at in our last episode, not passive, certainly not meek and mild as our culture projects onto her to maintain maybe our own gender norms. But instead, in Luke's gospel, Mary is active, making choices and decisions without consulting men. The angels approach her directly. She questions and engages in discussion with them before agreeing and consenting to bear this child. And then utters those revolutionary prophetic words of the Magnificat, which we looked at again in one of our previous episodes. This is far from the meek, mild, and passive woman that so often has been portrayed of Mary. This is a woman with the strength to make radical choices on her own, prepared to deal with the consequences of those decisions. This is a lot more like, in some ways, Eve in the Garden of Eden. This is a young woman who engages angels and questions them. And this is a strong prophetic woman who makes pronouncements on wealth, power, and politics. And so in Luke's gospel, this is a real challenge to how women are supposed to act and be in the world at that time. Because Mary is a theological thinker, but she's also a social prophet. And then we have in Luke's gospel the narrative where Mary travels on her own again to visit Elizabeth. Elizabeth is much older than Mary, so Luke in some ways provides us with a model of both a young and an older woman. Elizabeth is wise, very in tune with the Spirit, and immediately recognizes in Mary the change, but also prophetically sees the role Mary is going to play in history. And so she utters these words that have become central for any of us who pray the rosary. I don't know, Elizabeth, if you pray the rosary.
I don't pray
the rosary. Okay.
And some of that is just because growing up Baptist,
cultural,
we didn't have...
Yes.
I don't know if you know this, Baptists don't have set prayers. We don't have memorized prayers or anything like that. It's just being a non-liturgical denomination.
Okay.
Until I started going to a Lutheran church, I never had a prayer that was memorized except for the Our Father.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So myself, I love the rosary. And this is one of the most, in some ways, the rosary, central and beloved forms of prayer globally. And it is Elizabeth who utters these words that now we all say 2,000 years later. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God. And so this is the gift of Elizabeth to us, the clarity to see instantly who Mary is, not simply a young family relative, but chosen by God to bring the one who will change our world forever. And so Elizabeth says, why am I so favored that the mother of my Lord should come to me? Elizabeth can see that the child Mary carries will be the Lord and Savior. And this is interesting. Well before Peter or any of the other male disciples make these statements, it is a woman, while Jesus is still in the womb, who sees this and makes this declaration. And so Luke is showing the wisdom and the prophetic insight of woman, again, challenging the norms of wisdom being the prerogative of men. And it's interesting as well that in Luke's gospel, Mary and Elizabeth's faith are held up in contrast to Zechariah, who is the high priest at the time, but who ends up being struck dumb because of his doubt. Now, this contrast would not have been missed by readers at the time. And then Luke gives to us the account of Anna, again a prophet, again a woman who was not under the control of a husband for most of her life as she was widowed very young, a woman who was a mystic, lived in the temple with a deep spirituality, and she is the one who approaches the Holy Family in the temple when they come to present Jesus. And she immediately declares that this is the child all have been waiting for, who would redeem Jerusalem. So again, in Luke's gospel, it's that voice of prophecy, the voice of wisdom and insight, well before any declaration by a male disciples of Jesus as being Lord and Messiah. And so Luke shows us how the first declarations of who Jesus is come not from the male disciples many decades later, but actually from women. Because for Luke, women are not just wives and mothers, but Luke shows divine favor and divine action taking place through women. Luke shows us women filled with courage, wisdom, filled with the Holy Spirit, and proclaiming salvation and prophetic social change. And so in some ways, I feel like Luke's gospel doesn't just liberate women from gender norms and roles, but actually celebrates these aspects of women.
So it's interesting that you end with that point, because I'm going to talk about kind of the femininity of Luke.
Okay.
Last episode, I opened by mentioning that Luke is often called the women's gospel. And I'm going to let Deborah cover the biblical texts as she started out doing, but I think that thinking about it as the women's gospel is a really interesting place to start.
Mm.
When you think about the nativity story or stories, as we see them specifically in Matthew and Luke, we get, as we talked about last time, two very different perspectives. And one of those differences is seeing the story from Joseph's eyes versus Mary and Elizabeth and Anna, etc. And we can think about this as a gendered tale. We can think about it as telling the story from the mother's eyes or the father's eyes or however you want to parse it. But in one gospel, you have the stories of the women in Jesus's life. And in one story, you have the primary man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first off, consider that these are parental stories to begin with. These stories start out human and accessible, and regardless of whether it is a story of a king or a pauper, this story begins with a mother and a father. This is a family story, but the story is kind of gendered, and I want to talk about what that means because a lot of people don't know. To say something is gendered doesn't mean it is boy or girl or male or female. It's kind of like saying it is coded male or female. Mm. Like there is something about it that makes us think male or female. Mm. Now, generally, this is nonsense. There is nothing actually male or female or masculine or feminine about the vast majority of things, but we have assigned that value or trait to them. That's what it means to be gendered. So, for example, think of household chores. Are there some household chores that are mom chores or dad chores?
Mm.
Does it just kind of happen or make sense that the man mows the yard or takes out the trash while the woman does the dishes and vacuums? Now, this is all assuming a certain amount of heteronormativity, of course, mm-hmm. but my guess is that many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. This is what it means to be gendered. Women are perfectly capable of mowing, and men can do dishes with the best of them. But in many households, those are separated in kind of sex-specific ways.
Mm-hmm.
They are gendered. Lots of things are gendered for no good reason. Do you think of Legos as a boy's toy? Newsflash, that's dumb.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brick. There's nothing male about it. But for many people, it is gendered. It has to be pink and flowery before the brick is acceptable for girls. Do you think of kitchen sets as girls' toys? Also dumb. The vast majority of successful chefs in the world are men. In fact, it is a notoriously sexist industry, and you are much more likely to make it in the cooking world if you are a man. But domestic cooking? That's girl stuff. So it is two different things to make the claim that these two narratives are about a mother and father, and that these two stories are gendered. But in some ways, both of those claims kind of ring true. Luke's gospel tells us a story of poverty, tenderness, acceptance, grace, and the humble nature of a new family. It's a feminine story. Am I saying a woman told the story? No, I'm saying it's a gendered story. Luke's gospel tells us a story about the spiritual and physical hardships of a new family. Luke shares the songs and relationships of women who lift and support each other. It's a story about family and relationships and connection. It is ultimately a story about humility and tenderness. It is, in every way, a feminine account of the nativity. Compare that to Matthew. Matthew is a story of kings and politics. Matthew tells the story of Joseph's visions and his decisions of how to respond to his betrothed, about whether he should keep her or not. This is a story about Joseph's decisions, and it's a story about intrigue and action. In Matthew's account, they're foreign rulers traveling across known lands, involved in cloak and dagger type affairs, right? Sneaking in and out of the country. The narrative is about managing power and money as the Magi bring gifts, and Joseph probably had to keep all of that from Herod. And it's a bloody story. There's a massacre of the innocents. So there is gore and heartbreak, whereas in Luke, there's love and peace. So you can see how Matthew's account isn't just a completely different narrative. It is coded differently. Matthew's story is a masculine story. It's a story of powerful men doing important things. Where Luke is genteel and simple, Matthew is political and full of intrigue. Matthew is the Ian Fleming version, whereas Luke is Jodi Picoult.
I like that.
Right? That's what it means to say something is gendered. And my claim is that Matthew and Luke tell very gendered versions of the nativity story.
Absolutely. And yes, Matthew is a very different portrayal than Luke, centering Joseph. And yet it's interesting that in Matthew's gospel, the angel doesn't approach Joseph directly as they do Mary in Luke's gospel. The angel instead in Matthew's gospel always appears in a dream. So this isn't that direct communication of a woman with an angel, but instead a vision during sleep. I think it's an interesting difference. Joseph also does not question the angel. There's no engagement there. He simply wakes, considers the dream, and then acts in obedience. You might say in some ways that Matthew is a far more passive account between Joseph and the angel than Luke's version of Mary and the angel. In Matthew's gospel, no woman speaks. But what we do have, interestingly, is the contrast, I think, of masculinities. One is the masculinity of Joseph and the wise men. These men are open to their dreams. They take their dreams seriously enough to go into exile, travel to a foreign land, and allow their lives and plans to be completely turned upside down. In these masculinities, they obey the wisdom revealed in their dreams, and then they use that wisdom to protect. Joseph protects Mary and protects the Christ child, doing whatever it will take. These wise men, after another dream, do exactly the same. They use their wisdom to protect the Holy Family and don't go back to King Herod. But Herod in Matthew's gospel is the contrasting form of masculinity. This is a man who uses his knowledge of the coming birth of the Christ child to deceive, to lie, to pretend, and ultimately to kill, murder, and destroy. And so I think it's interesting that Matthew does seem to show us these contrasts of masculinities and how men engage and use their power. On one hand, we see male knowledge and power being used to protect, and on the other hand, male knowledge and power being used to kill. Again, in Matthew's gospel, we see the difference between the power of male humility versus male pride. Herod uses his power to try to hold on to his role, onto his power. He will not allow any challenge to his role as, air quote, king of the Jews. This is, I think, the male use of power to protect their pride, their position, and their ego. However, Matthew's gospel also shows us another way for men to be, where power is being used to protect and no attempt is being made to protect ego, status, or reputation. So Joseph willingly takes Mary to be his wife, even after it emerges that she's pregnant and not with his child. That would have been pretty unheard of in those days. Male pride would have been deeply damaged. Reputations would have been scarred, and the woman could easily have been stoned for bringing such dishonor and shame. Matthew's gospel shows us instead a man protecting her reputation, protecting the child that is not biologically his, and putting aside his own ego and pride. So too with the wise men, who we must remember are kings and rulers in their own right from foreign lands. They come to find this tiny baby, and they use their power not to feel threatened, but instead to bow the knee and worship. Kings choosing to bow down before a foreign child. Again, that is revolutionary in its own right, that male power will bend the knee to a child born into poverty. And so I think we must remember that Matthew's gospel is in many ways just as revolutionary as Luke's.
One of my advisors in grad school used to tell me over and over again that an analysis doesn't mean much if you don't answer the so what question. Why does this matter? What is the point of all that you have said? And it's an interesting thought experiment to talk about gender and negativity, obviously, and even more for me to make bold claims about how the birth of Jesus is gendered in different tellings. But ultimately, we have to ask, what does any of this actually mean, right? Like, we're talking about all this gender and revolutionary What is the point? So first, let's get the big question out of the way. Was this on purpose? And I'm almost certain it was not in many ways. When I am teaching my students to analyze a speech or an article or something, I'll give them a theory or methodology and I'll say, look for this effect or method or whatever we're looking for. And inevitably, there's some too cool for school kid who says, do you actually think they did this on purpose? And they are generally shocked when I say, oh, no, of course not. I do not for a minute think that Barack Obama sat down to write a speech and thought, I will use an appeal to logos at this exact point, any more than I think Luke sat down and said, I will write a gendered narrative. But I argue that they did.
Yeah.
That's what they wrote. Because this is not about authorial intent, it is about authorial effect. So let me explain what I mean. We have been doing things like storytelling, writing, singing, public speaking, all of this for thousands upon thousands of years. The rhetorical rules for that didn't exist for most of those years. We've been doing this much longer than we've been doing any kind of analysis. But that's actually what I'm saying. The rules didn't pre-exist before the communication. The rules describe what had already been established as effective. When we say effective speakers, writers, whatever, do X, it is not some random proclamation. It is because we have observed for thousands upon thousands of years that this thing, this X, is an effective tool of speakers, writers, and storytellers. So we've made a generalization, and we are now passing that on to people who are learning. This happens. That's what you're learning in things like speech or composition classes. We know from experience that this is effective. These are not arbitrary rules or observations. We have noted after so long, this is what people do. So, did Luke and Matthew set out to write gendered stories? Did they think, I'm going to write a masculine tale about the nativity? No, of course not. But that's not the question. The question is, what is the effect? Because Matthew and Luke did, so now what? And the effect is somewhat startling, because the whole of the Gospels tell us that Jesus's beginnings cannot be relegated to one thing or another.
Understood just in That's one right. way or the other.
Jesus's story starts in both a masculine and feminine way. Luke and Matthew give us both insights into Jesus's life that show us he will be a Messiah that will embody all parts of us. He will be a king. He will challenge powerful men and operate in the world of politics and the establishment, but he will also be a comforter for the outcasts. He will welcome in those who need shelter. Matthew and Luke give us a picture of a Messiah who is not just masculine or feminine, but embodies a whole person. The Jesus of the whole gospel is neither effeminate nor toxically masculine. He is a whole, balanced, and healthy person. He reaches people across the binary where they are at. The story of gender in the gospel is spelled out very early and pretty clearly. Jesus' story is both masculine and feminine, soft and strong. The gospel doesn't just provide a story of the perspective of the parents. It provides us with a picture of a whole and loving God.
Love that. And it's almost like for us to come to our full humanity, there has to be that integration of the masculine and feminine mm-hmm. within each one of us, that anima animus, you know? I think also what fascinates me for me in both of these Gospels is how both Luke's Gospel and Matthew's are in their own unique, very different ways, both so liberatory, but also revolutionary. You know, Luke's Gospel is completely turning on its head the traditional gender roles of women. Women are seen to be public transformers of history, active, prophetic, wise, challenging not just political and social powers, but even questioning angels. You know, we sing in Luke's Gospel that women are theologians and prophets. And in Matthew's Gospel, we see men trusting the intuition of their dreams, being prepared to travel and move and turn their worlds upside down, being prepared even to disobey kings and political rulers in order to protect a woman and her child. You know, in Matthew's Gospel, we see the liberatory power, I think, of a man who will use their knowledge and power to protect and not to harm, to protect against the powers that will harm and destroy, so that women and children can become who God has called them to be. In some ways, it's almost as though Luke and Matthew's Gospel belong together, as you say, because they reveal both this masculinity and femininity beyond gender norms, and how both men and women can use their power in wisdom, in ways that protect, in ways that save, in ways that transform our world. I honestly think that these texts are still radical, even for our day to day, and have so much to teach us as human beings.
Thank you for listening to The Priest and the Prof. Find us at our website, priestandprof.org. If you have any questions or concerns, feel free to contact us at podcast@priestandprof.org. Make sure to subscribe, and if you feel led, please leave a donation at priestandprof.org/donate. That will help cover the costs of this podcast and support the ministries of Trinity Episcopal Church. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed our time together today.
Music by AudioNautics.com.